What kind of fun is waiting for you at King's Island? The, holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The, make a splash all summer kind of fun. The, I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at King's Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun this season. King's Island is now open weekends.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Jay, that was an intense story.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, I almost cry during your conversations.
Yeah, I mean, but look, she's overcome the obstacles and it's amazing to see how she did it. And it's a valuable story. And it was an intense story. She went from basically homeless on the street, then in foster care, to being an incredibly successful person. She describes what she went through and how she rose up. What a powerful story. Here she is, Sulaima Gouhani. And also check out her recently funded AI startup, Happio, HAPPIOH.com. Here's the story.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
I can't believe it. I'm such a huge fan. I've been for years your fan. And when I started fundraising for my startup a few years ago, I've never done it before, a total amateur. It's a long story, but I listened to your podcast.
Oh, good.
Because I'll tell you why, because you have been so honest about your ups and downs and you have such an humble approach to life and you share so authentically all your considerations and thoughts and doubts and whatnot. And it helped me tremendously being more authentic in my journey as a CEO. And I do credit you for a lot of the stuff that have happened to me afterwards.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
And You're welcome.
Were you going through like a hard time just personally when you were fundraising? Like, was it because you get a lot of rejection when you're fundraising, particularly at first?
Yeah, but I was born on rejections, right? I mean, all my life, all doors have been slammed in my face, right? I mean, thousands of no's. All my entire life has been covered with no's, right? So I'm pretty strong in being rejected. That's not the hard part. But it was more about keeping my mind sharp and train myself to be an optimist. Because just like you, I'm not a natural optimist. I'm actually slightly depressed, negative. I mean, I can explain, but throughout your entire podcast, all the shows I've listened to, you have had your ups and downs, and you have shared so generously how you stayed curious and optimistic and all these things, and you're eager for learning throughout those processes and seasons, if you like.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Like, I feel that I'm an optimist, but I have to force myself to be an optimist in the sense that there's nothing to be gained from pessimism because you want to be realistic. Okay, this will work, this won't work. Mm-hmm. And here's the evidence for that. And I'll make a decision. Like, you always have to make decisions based on realism, but you have to be hopeful to try things and start things and pursue things. You know, an experience helps gain the optimism doesn't help you gain the realism, but nor does pessimism. Experience helps you, you know, and having good network of people around you helps you gain realism. And, you know, for you, I imagine it must be interesting because long before your CEO days, mm-hmm. you were, when you were a kid, you were on the street.
Yeah.
Can you tell me that, mm-hmm. that story? Like, what happened? Obviously you've changed your life circumstances considerably since then.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the short story is that I ran away from my parents when I was just 13. I got confirmed in Denmark when I was 13, and you know, you get usually cash, right? From parents and grandparents and stuff. And I was so excited about being confirmed because I knew that will give me cash. But unlike my friends, I wasn't planning to buy myself a bike or, you know, I was planning to run away from my parents, which was pretty insane.
And why is that? Like, what was going on?
Well, that's a long story too, but I'm half Moroccan. I was born in Morocco. I came to Denmark. My mom is Danish. So I grew up in Denmark. But I grew up with a very traditional dad, right? Imagine having a Muslim Moroccan dad and growing up in the most liberal free country in the world, probably Denmark. It gave a lot of friction. And my dad was actually an engineer, very well educated, but he had undiagnosed ADHD. He went bankrupt twice. We lost everything several times. They had a very passionate marriage. So much so that sometimes we had to escape in the nights to go to a women's center for safety from my dad. He started drinking, abusive, you know. And I came from an upbringing where, you know, my uncle was a pedophile, you know. I mean, I can go on and on with all the trauma that I have been through.
Can I ask, was your mom, even though she had, let's say, escaped several times to a women's center, often it takes 5, 6, 10 attempts or more before the woman finally leaves an abusive husband. I mean, it's very rare that the first time she's able to leave for good. They usually go back for many reasons, like, oh, maybe he's changed. Maybe it was my fault. She could blame herself. Like, what was going on? Did she eventually leave him or did she go back or?
James, you are so insightful. No, she never managed to leave him. In fact, so he died 16 years ago. He died. And so, yeah, it took him to die for her to leave him. So it's true. It's very hard for a woman to leave an abusive husband because truth is that when you are in such a violent, abusive relationship, marriage, what most people don't know is that these women are not stupid, right, or weak. But over time, you lose confidence and you kind of get addicted to that dramatic lifestyle as well.
And you probably get like a PTSD. Like you probably 100%. Are just shattered.
100%. And I remember I was like maybe 5, 6, 7 years old. I was begging her to leave him. My brother was begging her. We were frightened. You know, it was very traumatic. But she never left him. No. And, you know, today I'm 48. I look back at my life with different kind of eyes. I feel even gratitude, right? Because my upbringing has really prepared me for the life that I live today. So I'm no longer angry, upset. I don't feel like a victim, but I am aware that my trauma score is very high. Actually so much so that when you look at what I have accomplished now as an adult, I think I have 0.2% chance of living the life I live today, right? So I've really beaten all odds.
Right. I mean, that's what struck me when I first was, you know, when we first met through Avo and stuff. Mm. Like, so when you were 13 and you left, where did you go? Like, what was the first thing that happened?
Well,
I hope you don't mind me asking.
No, please. No. I think it's, you know, it's so, I was in India teaching at Indian School of Business. It's like MIT, but in India, super smart people. And I stood up and I shared my story with the students that I ran away when I was 13. I lived in the streets. And usually people get shocked, right? And just like you, I guess. But in India, the students were just like, yeah, and so move on. You know, for them, it was not a big deal because it was India. You know what I mean? But in any other country in Europe, this is, you know, this is a big deal.
Sure.
Well, I mean, I gathered, you know, clothing. I wrote a note to my parents that I had left and they shouldn't be looking for me. They called the police, of course, and all the newspapers were alerted and I was front page on the newspapers in Denmark because they were searching for me. And eventually, a few months later, the police found me. Some family members were hiding me, friends. And then they found me and they transported me to an institution, children's home, right? It's a 24-hour open institution where you bring kids in that, you know, cannot be at home for some reason. Very tough place. James, it's a very tough place.
Were the police and whoever found you, were they sympathetic to your cause and just that there was no place to really take you other than this institution?
Yeah, they called my parents, but my parents didn't want me back. So I went to that institution and I was there with a bunch of really interesting kids, I would say. And I was just 13. It's really... and I was sitting there, I remember, with a few, with a little bit of cash from the welfare office, whatever. And I had a pack of cigarettes and I was sitting there literally 13 years old with a pack of cigarettes and a few note, you know, $100 or whatever. And I didn't know what to do with my life. And that institution, actually, after a few months, they sat me down and they said, we cannot have you here. You need to go back to your parents. You need to go back to a real school because you're too smart for us to have you here. We will destroy your future. You, and I didn't want to go back. But my parents then agreed on taking me back. But I was only home for a few weeks. It didn't work. And then I ran away again. And this
was there
time,
an inciting event? Like, was your father...
It was just a mistake, you know. It didn't work. I mean, we immediately start fighting again and, you know, yelling. And it was very unpleasant. And I should also tell you that a few days after I returned to my parents' house, I went back to my old school. And I came to school really excited to be back to school. I love going to school. This is seventh grade. And when I came to school, just before everyone returned to their classes, one of my teachers came to me in the schoolyard. Everyone had left in for classes. And he kept me there and he looked at me. I'm just 13, James. And he looks at me and he said, you know, you're no longer welcome at this school. And I said, what? And he said, all the parents, none of the parents want you back in the class. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. Because there was one place on earth where I really felt I really wanted to be, and that was school. It was just my home that didn't work. It was my home was broken. Anyway, so I got kicked out of seventh grade, and it took. And then I left again my home, and this time, the social welfare system in Denmark put me in foster care. But before I went to foster care, they actually put me in another school. It's like a boarding school, but it's an institution. And all the children there were criminal. Like, what I wasn't capable of at that time, I definitely was when I left. So it was a very, very bad crowd. I was there for almost a year. And yeah, that was tough. And then I was put in foster care, and then from foster care to another institution, from another institution to, yeah. So I would say I've had 10 really interesting years of my youth that has deeply defined me as a person.
I mean, in foster care in general has a reputation of being a very negative experience. I've seen foster parents, though, who have been very good foster parents. And, you know, I've seen both sides of the story. Mm-hmm. What was your experience like in foster care?
Very good. In fact, so much so that my children love visiting my foster family still. We celebrate Christmas with them. They remember my birthday and they reach out to us. And when I'm home, my foster mom would say, now all my children are together, you know, if her children are there too. I definitely feel a very strong relationship with my foster family still.
Oh, that's great.
They went to my wedding and everything, yeah.
And then at what point, I guess when you're 18, do you have to leave the foster care system, or what happens? Like, do you go to college then, or what did you do?
Yeah, I mean, I left earlier because they lived a bit away from the main town, you know. So I left the family when I was just 16, 16 and a half. And I started living by myself in a house that was governed by the social system. I lived there with, let me think, 6 or 7 other young people, same age. And then we had an adult that lived on the first floor. But we ran the house like any other adult. Like, we had cleaning schedules, grocery shopping schedules, cooking schedules, but we ran the house. We had like our financials, our books, we had to pay rent. It was so by the age of 16 and a half, I was living a completely adult life with all the concerns that you would normally have when you're like 25, maybe, you know?
And so were you working during the day or trying to study or?
Yeah, yeah, I did study actually. Yeah, I graduated, you know, the high school and all that. And but I was working because I needed to make money. So I was cleaning in the nights or bartending or I took a degree as a personal trainer. I did all kinds of stuff that could give me an income. So I've always worked outside going to school as well.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle. And it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, "Good things come to those who wait." I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. When you were like 18, 19, 20, what did you think about yourself? What did you think your potential was at that point? Like, here you are in life with essentially nothing, but perhaps happy to be an adult and finally free, whatever that word means.
Yeah, true.
What did you think of your potential at this point? Like, where were you emotionally?
Well, it's such a good question. I'll try not to be emotional when you ask me it. You know, fast forward, if I look back at how I felt when I was 18, I was a very serious 18-year-old. You know, sometimes when you meet people that are 18, 19, they're living their best lives, right? I was a very serious, slightly worried, traumatized. And I was a little behind with a lot of things. Remember, I was kicked out of school for several years I was trying to survive. So school was an issue for me. There was a lot, you know, there's a lot I had to catch up with.
Did you look at other kids and or other people your age who are, maybe you would see them in the street, maybe you would see them, you know, moving up some ladder of success, however that's defined?
I was not.
And were you like thinking, oh, I could be like them? Or were you thinking I could never be like them?
It's funny that you say that. I always knew that I was going to make it. Like, I was never in doubt that one day, James, it was not like I'm going to show the rest of the world that they was missed. No, it was not like that. It was just that I knew I would make it. I just knew that I had to go through these phases or seasons or whatever. This was my life journey. This was the chapters that was laid out for me. And even though I could be sad or disappointed or whatever, that this was my life, then I settled. Like, not settle is not the right word, but I accepted that this was, I surrendered. I know you surrendered, James, to life too, and I think we share that. I surrendered to the journey that I was on, and I accepted every challenge that was thrown at me, and I focused mainly on just doing my very best in all of those situations that I was put into. And yes, I couldn't get a job. Actually, I applied for any education, university degree, whatever you can imagine, turned down everywhere. I couldn't even get, a job. What you might not think about, but my name, Sulaima Gourani, is not a Danish name. It's very Moroccan. It's very Muslim. It's very... So if I send any applications, no one took me. In fact, when I was just about 18 and a half, after I have sent out several applications, I just became a student. I graduated. I couldn't get a job. I went to the... Because I was part of the social welfare system, there's an office and you can go and, you know, they can try and find you a job as an adult, you know, whatever. And that lady, she looked at me and she said, I don't think we can find anything suitable for you. The only job that I have right now that you can begin on Monday is to be painting, was a building or whatever, like an activity. You know, we can activate you so that you can get some welfare money, but you have to paint that wall. You know, that's the only job that comes to mind that I can give you. And I'm like, really? Really? And instead of taking the job, I went and I took my passport and I moved to Switzerland.
Wow. So that's a big change. I guess, though, you were comfortable with being in different situations at the very least, like more so than many people your age, perhaps. And so you had the confidence. Do you think that gave you the confidence to oddly pick up and move to another country?
Yeah, I've done that 4 times now. Well, I think it's in my DNA. If something doesn't work, despite all I do and all my good intentions, instead of staying, I'm not running away. That comes to mind, but that's not what's happening. I'm like, okay, if I have to move myself physically to another place to make it work, then that's what I'm going to do.
I would think Switzerland would be just as hostile to...
No,
Muslims and or actually any non-Swiss people, because it's a very like closed society. They're very different from other European countries, Switzerland.
True. And very traditional still. In Switzerland back then, when I was 18 and 19, they were looking for Danish women who would come and be a waiter, like in restaurants and bars. And I have been, you know, serving people in restaurants and bars most of my youth because that... You know, I switched between being a dishwasher, waiter, or cleaning lady, right? I mean, the hospitality industry is very important for people like me because you can not only make yourself a salary, but it's a very welcoming industry, right, for immigrants and people who don't do well in school. In many ways, just like the tech industry, which is what I work with today, those two industries are very welcoming for anyone who would like to, who can work hard and don't complain. Tech and hospitality, two very generous industries for immigrants. So I moved to Switzerland and I worked there for 6 months and I managed to make enough money. They tip very well, James. They tip very well in Switzerland.
Well, that's good. I should tell my daughters. They're actresses / writers / waiters, bartenders.
Yeah.
So
as they should be, right? Oh, that's the journey for many creative. So I collected a lot of money and then I moved back to Denmark. And then I had enough money to move to a larger city. you know, Denmark is very small, but we have a few big cities. We have Odense, Copenhagen, and so forth. And I moved to the second biggest city in Denmark, and that was called Odense. And I worked there for a few years in different stores and shops and stuff. And then at some point, I ran out of money. And I considered studying something, right? And but I couldn't get in, really. I didn't have the grades. I didn't have the connections to get in anywhere. But I managed to find an education that lasted 4 years. And you didn't have to have high grades. And you could apply. And I did. And they accepted me. And I studied there for 4 years. And I hated it. Every day. I was not good at it. I hated it. But the good thing about that program was that it did motivate you to move to a different country every year as part of the program.
Oh, really? That's an interesting program. That's I like that.
Yeah, it was critical. It was
what countries did you move to?
So I moved to Luxembourg and Norway as the two main countries. And then that took me a step further to US afterwards. So yeah, it was very interesting. So I moved to Luxembourg shortly after.
You know, Luxembourg's like one of those countries, I've never met anybody from Luxembourg. Like, what happens there?
Nothing.
I just imagine there's like a lot of like wealthy people there.
Yeah.
And that's about
it. Old wealthy people. It's Miami, but in Europe. Well, I think Luxembourg is very... everything is in order, right? Everything works. It used to be just like Switzerland, financial institutions, wealthy people who would live there. I got an Erasmus scholarship. People started noticing me at that point, James. That was really where it started. Slowly, people recognized
In what sense?
Well, you know, Danes don't move around a lot, right? And moving countries for a job is not something you have to do if you're Danish, right? You can live your life comfortably all your life in Denmark and do fine. Once you start leaving the country and you return and you leave again, you start making noise, right? And I think it was around that time that the Danish government, a minister of some kind, social minister or whatever, picked up that here's a woman, a young woman that is doing an extraordinary effort to make it in life. And she happens to be Danish, half Danish. And they interviewed me for a report. And that led to another interview, another interview, another interview. And it turns out I became, out of nowhere, I started becoming some kind of a role model. They studied me, James. They kind of started studying me, which was a surprise.
How old were you at this point?
Maybe 19. 20.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And I never thought about it, that I have a certain way of thinking. I never thought about that it's a miracle that I survived my own life.
In some sense, I mean, I'm not saying anything is good about the situation that happened to you as a child, but you definitely had to learn skills that other 19-year-olds are not learning. And that is interesting because it's very rare for someone to have to learn those skills. And then, like you said, move on to success, like an education and you know, living in these other countries and other situations, and to survive that, people probably were curious, like, well, what are these skills she developed, and how did she develop them, and what's she doing now, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I became a role model project for the Danish government. And I have participated in, I don't know, 1,000 talks and podcasts and interviews and reports, and I don't know what, because they're trying to find out if you can channel a few of the things that I've been through and the way I handled it to other young people. Because I'm not the only one, right? I'm not the only one that is going through these things or have been through these things, but I might be one of those who kind of made it to the surface, right? And someone saw me. So in a way, I've been lucky.
Did you keep in touch with anybody that you knew from the institutions, like the other children who were in?
I do not. No, I do not. But my foster parents I was there this summer, and they gave me a long rundown on all the people, all the young people that I know and have known, and with whom I also shared my foster family with, because they had other foster kids than me. And it's very traumatic. None of them have barely survived their own life.
Wow. And at what point did you start, you know, I imagine here you were on this unusual path. And again, it's both a curse and a blessing in the sense that to be an entrepreneur, you have to basically go on an unusual path. You have to discover something that no one has discovered before and do it in a unique way. Not in every case for an entrepreneur, but in most cases. Mm-hmm. You went through all this trauma. And again, you probably had your own version of PTSD, just like your mom from growing up in that situation.
Yeah.
What were the consequences of that? Like what was negative going on in your life then?
You know, I never really thought about I could have post-traumatic stress disorder. But and I have never been diagnosed or anything, but lately, because I've been interviewing other leaders that are looking into psychedelics, trauma, post-traumatic stress disorders and stuff, ADHD and stuff, I'm like, yeah, I'm 100% sure that I have a great amount of those to deal with. And I was just never diagnosed, right? So should I or should I just live in unknown, Lee, about that?
Probably. That's a hard question because sometimes when you just label yourself with an illness, then you take on the illness and maybe you're fine without it. So
yeah,
seems
you
like
know,
you've been fine without the label and perhaps I shouldn't have had the assumption to label you, but you know, you ran away from home for a reason and that reason was very important to you and it was in your head and those reasons are still in your head. But you're just older now.
Yeah. And now I'm a parent, right? So, well, I mean, now I almost forget what you asked me about, but
what was still sticking with you that somehow the other kids didn't or young people didn't seem to have?
I definitely felt that I didn't have the privilege to just live life, you know? I don't remember at any point of time where I had like even one day where I was not worried. And this has been a constant in my life. Even today, right? As an entrepreneur, and don't get me wrong, James, I live the most privileged life you cannot buy for money. You know, it's unbelievable. My life now is insane. Like it's a fairy tale. I cannot believe that I'm living the life I'm living. But even today, at this very moment, despite that I'm outperforming statistically 99.9% of all startups at our stage, I'm still, every morning I wake up, heavenly burdened with the responsibility and the worry some of, you know, and it's just my nature. Someone told me a few years ago that those who survive are those who are slightly paranoid.
Andy Grove, who was the former CEO and basically a co-founder of Intel, wrote a book, Only the Paranoid Survive.
See? And then also, because I've been through so much and I was kicked out of school in seventh grade and, you know, we spoke about math, right? And I have not had a math class since fourth grade.
Well, this goes along with a theory of mine on education, which is that most things we learn, like for instance, nobody ever uses geometry in real life. I mean, if that's your job to be like an engineer and you build bridges, you should use geometry or calculus or whatever. No one uses calculus anywhere or trigonometry.
No,
I had to take tons of tests on all this stuff and do years of homework, and I've never once used it. And I think that holds for almost every field in school. That most things we should be learning other things and not the things that are currently taught.
Well, don't even get me started on this. You know, part of what I spend my spare time on is, you know, I co-designed a teacher's prize. We hand out $1 million to the best teacher in the world every year. The best school prize for the best schools in the world. Also a member of the jury there. I've been leading the global dignity movement globally for 10 years, right? It's all about schools, education, and kids. And I do spend to this very day a great amount of my time discussing the future of education. A few of my books are about what are we supposed to learn? What are we supposed to be in the future? You know, my TEDx talk, everything is around the fact that, hey, listen, I have traveled to more than 40 countries telling my story. And James, you said about something a while ago that I love you for that you were considering to buy Greenland. Remember Trump wanted to buy Greenland and you came up with this whole thing. And it made me think about my trip to Greenland. As you know, Greenland is Danish.
Which I did not know initially.
Yeah,
until
okay.
The Prime Minister of Denmark responded to Trump and said, Greenland's not for sale. And I'm like, what the hell is that guy doing there?
Oh, it's Danish. We're proud of Greenland, but we kind of messed it up as well. That could be a whole nother conversation. Anyway, Greenland is facing a 50% dropout. Kids drop out of school. It's a huge problem.
Yeah, and alcoholism is a real problem there. Suicide's a real problem there.
Suicide, alcohol, and abuse in homes. Mm. Sexual abuse. Anyway, so you can imagine that I am the ideal person to ship to Greenland and put in front of those kids because I survived a similar upbringing. And I still remember they took me to this high school. And I don't know, I would like to say there was 300-500 kids in the school. It was in the capital, Nuuk of Greenland. And I started sharing my story. And when I was done, usually, you know, people applaud you or whatever, right? Complete silence. And they just started sitting crying. And it was the most moving talk I've ever done in my entire life. And because in all silence, we were just all crying how hard life is for so many children. Sorry, I get emotional, but it was a very emotional moment. Yeah. And I knew that, you know, I have not been through all these things for no reason. I am supposed to bring that hope back in some way. And that is why I cannot help myself from sharing my story, not as a victim, but more of, you know, yeah, I know. I was, what have I been, 13 and a half when I was returned to my parents for the second time and I ran away again. That time I ran to my mom's sister and she had me living there for a few weeks before I was put in foster care. And I lived with her a few weeks so that I could attend school. And I remember one afternoon I was opening my lunch bag that she had made for me. And in that was a little note that I should not return back home that afternoon. She didn't want to have me there anymore.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, James, you know, because she had found a cannabis pipe or joint, whatever thing, in my school bag. And yeah, I'm not proud of that, but hey, you know, that's my story, right? And so instead of dealing with it, she just said, can you imagine being at that age? You've been through all this and you just have in your lunch bag a note, don't return home after school. Do whatever you want, just don't come home.
Where did she think you were going to go?
Yeah, just like anything.
Aunt.
Yeah, I mean, James, what do you do? But I went to the social welfare system and they called their foster care family and stuff. So all good. But the thing is, I don't think I've ever shared this before in a show. I don't think so. Anyway, that afternoon I took my bike after school, but I didn't know where to go. And I was standing on the bridge, you know, and thinking that I should just jump. I didn't. And I'm so happy I didn't.
Why do you think you didn't?
I don't know. I had this feeling of somehow I thought a few years ahead, like, could this work out? Do I have the strength? Can I pull myself up by the hair and get myself an education and maybe a job and, you know, and I did.
Did you know Bridgestone developed a tire using 75% recycled and renewable materials? Making a difference today for future generations. That's what really matters. Bridgestone, solutions for your journey. Visit whatreallymatters.com to learn more.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, you put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor, because you know the bigger the fight, the better the reward. Medela, the mark of the fight. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Fast forwarding, like then you achieved all this incredible stuff and survived and then even went to school and went to all these other countries. Mm. What then propelled you even further? Because then you started being a consultant to really big
the biggest
places
companies in the world. Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible.
And then of course you became an entrepreneur and so on.
Yeah. Well. Remember I told you that I studied that awful education that took 4 years and that motivated all the children to move out 3-4 countries during the study. Mm-hmm. In my final year, I was offered to go to Norway. And I was offered a 6-month program at the foreign ministry in Norway. They offered me a position for 6 months. And that turned around my life. And here we go. Because I came there and I'm a survivor, right? I'm a social, intelligent, street smart hustler, right? I get things done. I'm extremely good at networking, if you may. Why? Because that's how I survived. That's how I got clean clothing or food or a bed to sleep in or whatever, through networking, right? That was my survival skill. And so I have a very extraordinary skill for relationship building. It's really my number one skill, but it is my survival skill, right? Funny enough. And so I started working at the embassy and they, you know, took me out to conferences and whatnot. And, you know, I was exchanging business cards like no one else. And they realized she's a talent. And I decided I want to pursue a career in the foreign ministry. I would become the first Danish-Moroccan ambassador ever. But then during that period of time, I met a CEO in Norway. He was, of course, Norwegian, and he had a small company with 100 employees or something. And he has been thinking about starting a new product, a new software product. There was nothing yet. There was just one string of code, one developer. It was really an innovative side gig that he was thinking about starting. And we met and through the work, through the embassy, because he really wanted to export his software into Denmark. And that's the job of an embassy, is to build trade relations, right? And so we started talking and then he offered me a job. And that was the first time ever. I must have been 21 something, 22. And he offered me a job. I had never, ever in my entire life ever been recruited or offered a job anywhere at all. It was the first time. And I didn't speak the language very well, Norwegian, right? I did not. It's similar to Danish, but it's still a different language, right? I had never worked with tech before. I knew how to turn on a computer, but I had never worked with software before. And I had never been, you know, a salesperson per se. Definitely not SaaS software sales. Forget it. But I thought, you know, why not? Let me try it. And within 6 or 7 months, I had done the biggest European installment of any early stage software ever. And we had no marketing budget, nothing. And fast forward, 4 years after, we were in 44 countries. I had scaled that company. I had returned to Denmark. I lived in a penthouse apartment in Copenhagen. I made hundreds of thousands of dollars a month. I was throwing the wildest champagne parties in Copenhagen. All this within 4 years.
Wow. What do you think made your sales? Like, what was your sales technique?
Well, I have a really good eye for. I've always done early stage software. You know, where there basically is nothing. Right? There is no proven sales pitch. There's no return on investment paper. It's all vision. It's all, we can draft this together kind of thing. And that require a very special set of skills. I now know that, but I didn't know that at that time. So it happens to be that I'm very good in identifying in any country who is the most powerful person in that country that I should know. How do I get in touch with that person? How do I get a meeting with that person? And I'm very quick and very good in identifying what is this person's vision, him or herself, like what would they like to achieve in life? And then I speak into that vision with the product and say, let's go on this journey together, shall we?
So what's an example of, like, you're entering into a new country, mm-hmm. and you, who was the important person? How did you meet them? And you're like 21, 22, 23 years old at this point. Why would they meet you?
Yeah. First and foremost, you know, you do represent something they find exciting. And tech can be very exciting for an ambitious company, for an ambitious CEO or whatever, right? They want to know what is the new thing boiling? What could be the thing that could set my company up against, you know, my competitors? And if you can talk into that and you have a slightly good vocabulary for, you know, visionary business development, you know, kind of phrases, then you can get a meeting. The meeting is not the hard thing. The hard thing is to get in there and build that vision and make them trust you that you can build that together with them. Well, I mean, to find out who's the most powerful person is really not that difficult. You just open any newspaper, you just open the local news, whatever, in that country. And you slightly, now it's easy because you can search everything, you have social media and stuff. But back then we didn't have all of that, right? I mean, we did have internet, of course, right? It's 99 and 98, 99 and 2000s, but that was not the same.
But, you know, the internet was there also in the newspapers, but people weren't necessarily using it. Particularly CEOs who had been running their business for 20 years. No. They were just like, what's this internet thing? Is it a fad? And so you can, but it was exciting enough that people, you're right, people would want to know from a young person in particular, what is this internet thing?
Yeah. That's how we did it. And and you know, it was very hard back then to find someone's email or phone number, and you had to go through PAs and stuff and, you know, had to do the groundwork. Actually, it's kind of, I wrote a book about, you know, in 2001 to just an ebook or whatever, just a PDF file, you could call, whatever, just a very easy, you know, a very light book about how to map, nurture, and expand a professional network, right? And back then, I had no idea, you know, I've never seen such a book. In fact, I was in 2001 invited to the stock exchange in Denmark. You have to remember, this is just a few years prior. I couldn't get a job, right? I left the country, and here I am. They flew me back to the stock exchange to give my first public speak ever, and media was there. And they were like, Sulaima, we need to know how you are doing this. How are you taking this Norwegian company to the commercial success you have? We've never heard about you before. This is extraordinary. And they knew, because one of the installments that I did was for a very, very, very large Danish retailer. So it was out there in the news, right? And I stood up there young, never gave a public speech before, and I didn't know what to say. So what I did was I just took a pen and a whiteboard, and I started explaining how I think of networking and how I process and map and think about relationships building, and how you can nurture and how you can kind of, I don't like the word use, but monetize your network. And this was before anyone had ever, I don't remember, I've never seen a networking book or whatever, strategic networking class or whatever. It was just, it came intuitive to me because, James, it is my survival skill.
Yeah, you had to be able to.
Yeah, it was, yeah, exactly. And it was this only skill that I knew of that was networking, but I didn't even know it was called networking, right? Now we know.
But the other thing you probably did too was, you probably had really strong empathy for what their problems might be. And since it sounds like your SaaS software, and this is like before probably the phrase SaaS even was really commonly used, they'd say, well, we need this, and you probably said, we could do that, whether or not you could do it.
100%. That's it. Yeah, that was a bit.
That's great when you're selling something that actually, that's the one benefit of not having a competitor. When you have a competitor, you could say, well, we're better in this way and we're worse in this way, and you guys decide. But when you don't have a competitor, sometimes it means there's no competitor because there's no need. But the internet was so new, SaaS software was so new, there probably was a need, but you had to kind of figure it out together with the customer.
Yeah. And luckily we could deliver, right? It was really good software.
What did it do? Like what kind of?
You're going to laugh. But it was, so you have to imagine this is year 2000, 99, 2000. And I was mainly selling to retail chains. And I spoke to the headquarter of any chain, right? Retail. And I said, wouldn't it be amazing if you could sit at your headquarter and you could see real time the sales and if you could, you know, push education and notifications and messages to each of your stores. And
It's great.
It's so great. It's still a really great software. And we did very well. And this was before business intelligence, data management, e-learning.
Yeah, this whole thing became a huge industry.
It became the
dashboard
just
for CFOs and CEOs.
Exactly. And real time for your stores, right? And so I did really well with that. And I was living the best life in Copenhagen again. And I couldn't believe my own luck. And then something completely unrealistic happened. I made my parents so happy and proud. I don't think they've been any prouder of me. Then I got a call from Heidrick & Struggle, you know, the big headhunter company.
Yeah.
And they were like, someone wants to hire you. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, really? And they said, yeah, it's Maersk Shipping, you know, the biggest shipping company in the world. And they were like, they want you to come and be responsible for, they have a new department. It's called e-learning. And they really want you to come and build relationship with the biggest financial institutions and companies and customers. Maersk Shipping had a IT department called Maersk IT, and they wanted to hire me. And I'm like, wow, I cannot pass all the IQ testing and whatnot. So I don't know, you know, they only hire the smartest people. It's, to this day, it's still one of the most prestigious companies to work for in the world.
Sure. They do, people might not have heard of them, but they do, for instance, a lot of shipping out of the Middle East for everybody in the world to have oil.
Yeah, so. I mean, the blue containers with the little star, that's Maersk. And I knew at that point, I couldn't believe, you know, it couldn't become bigger, right? And they wanted me to come and work for them. They want to recruit me. The tables had turned. So I ended up accepting a job, and I...
What happened to the company with the SaaS software? That guy was probably upset that you left.
He was very upset, but he was very sweet about it. I think he was proud also, right? And in the
farewells... Did you have shares? Like, were you able to monetize your...
Yeah, I did have shares, but it was before I really understood how to monetize those and buy them. And, you know, stock options are really not easy if you're in Denmark. It's still not a thing they really know how to do well. So people don't have ownership in startups and so forth. But anyway, in his farewell speech, he said something super kind. He said two things. He said, when we hired you, we could not understand a word of what you were saying because I spoke another language, right? I speak Danish and they speak Norwegian. And you had never done such a job before, but we decided to hire you. And I said, well, I still don't understand why you hired me. And he said, because when you walked in that door, we felt all your energy. And we knew that you would learn anything that you need to succeed in the job. And here we are 4 years later. And, you know, he's still very proud because then, you know, fast forward, I became 40 under 40, thinkers 50. I became young global leader with Mark Zuckerberg. I've received all those kind of rewards afterwards, right? So he's still very proud because he kind of found me, if you will, right?
And so now you're at Maersk.
Then I had Maersk, and then Maersk ended up selling the department that I was part of. Ah, IBM bought us. And I never envisioned me working for IBM. I'll tell you, I love IBM. I have the deepest respect for them, but they just work slightly different. I had more freedom at Maersk. I could do it my way. That was definitely not the situation in IBM. So I met with the CEO of IBM, actually, for Denmark, Ole. I hope he's still around. I'm not sure, but I get a chance to meet with him even. Like, it was here I am, this foster child, school dropout, was kicked out of my mom's sister's house because of a joint, you know, who am I sitting there in my suit with the CEO of IBM? And he said, you know, Sulaima, I cheer you. I admire you. I just don't think IBM is for you. Like, I think you're more unique than that. I don't think you should spend your life in IBM. At first, I was very devastated. I felt turned down. But he gave me a gift, you know, he set me free. And it took only, I guess, a few weeks. Then I got another call from another headhunter. from Hewlett Packard. And then Hewlett Packard said, would you like to come and work for us? They have never had, I was the youngest
hire.
That's
funny because they have similar cultures to IBM, I would think. I don't know.
Yeah, I think Hewlett Packard back then were more like cowboys, right? There was more freedom. Mm. They did things their way and stuff. IBM was more the black school of, you know, a certain way of doing things. HP is more wild. It used to be. I don't know how it is today. And they said, why don't you come over and why don't you become responsible for Hewlett Packard and Microsoft, the partnership between us? And I'm like, whoa. And I was like, what am I supposed to do? And they said, well, we will give you 45 people reporting to you. It's the smartest engineers we have. And you shall build our service business for Microsoft with HP. What many people don't know is that HP and Microsoft are actually strategic partners because they want to win deals from Dell and IBM. So they have something called frontline partnership. And that partnership was really not going well. I think to some extent, you could even say that Microsoft and HP did not like each other. And they said, can you go and fix this? And I said, I don't know. I've never tried it before, but I'll give it a chance. And it is to this day still the best job I've ever had in my life. And when I left HP, I had, as the only HP employee, I had a key access card to Microsoft. I came and in and out of the building just as I liked. To this day, still I have calls and meetings with Microsoft. They still love me for what I did for them and with them. We won a lot of deals. And I was promoted to become responsible for our service department for entire HP, very young, yeah. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And but I actually burned out. I was picked up twice by the ambulance because I had a complete burnout.
What does that mean? Like, why were you picked up by the ambulance?
Because I thought I had a heart attack, but it was an anxiety attack, but I didn't know. I know this may sound really stupid, but I didn't know that I was stressed. No one had like told me this job that you have can make you stressed. And this is how stress looks like. I had no idea. When you are a traumatized person like me with this life journey, one thing that we are not good at, I think, is to listen to our signals, right? I mean, you're tired.
Because like you said earlier, you didn't even have one day where you could take a break from that worry. Like you had to constantly, you know, hustle for yourself.
Yeah, so I
can probably turn that part of your brain off.
Turned it off completely. I have actually been practicing the last 10 years to acknowledge that I'm tired or I need food or, you know, I was 47 kilos. I worked 20 hours a day. James, I loved it, but it's not healthy, right? So I was picked up by the ambulance and my doctor said, you know, if we're picking you up one more time, then I want you to quit job. And I couldn't quit, you know. For me, my life was work, you know. I was really good at it. Finally, I found something that I'm good at, very good at. So I decided to leave my position. There was a new CEO from HP, both globally, but also in Denmark. And I left my position and I took a smaller job. I took a small job that was international director still, but only with 12 people reporting, medical device, something else, just a cozy little job. And I took my MBA and all that on the side, of course. And I got my MBA, by the way, I was not even halfway qualified to take an MBA, but MBA, the school gave me a wild card. I can tell you about how I managed to get an MBA without being qualified. But and then a few months later, I find out that I'm pregnant in the new job. And I tell
now,
the...
when did you meet your husband?
Yes, that's a very, very important question. I met him when I was 20, just before I moved to Luxembourg for that job in Luxembourg. I met him in a bus. And I met him, but I didn't talk to him. I was with my girlfriend and he was in the bus with his best friend. And we didn't talk, but we saw each other. And I told my girlfriend, oh my God, if I could marry that guy. He's the most beautiful person I've ever seen. And he said the same thing to his friend. We didn't know. And then 6 months later, I meet him at a bar and he pulled me in, you know, and whispers in my ear, we need to talk. And we've been together ever since. That's 28 years ago.
Wow. Now, do you find that the trauma you experienced and the, what you saw your parents go through, sometimes these things, you know, not always the case, but sometimes boys inherit from the father and girls inherit from the mother. And did any of that come into play in your relationship at all?
I was so afraid of committing myself in a relationship. I had no recipe of what does it mean to have a good marriage. I definitely did not want to have kids because I was so afraid of, you know, maybe I would, traumatize my own children. I've heard that if you have been abused as a child, you might end up abusing your own children. You know, I was very afraid of all these things. But Brian, my husband, is the most healthy person, the most non-traumatized person I know on earth. He is emotionally sober. He's so sober. Like, he is incredible. I mean, James, he saved my life. I don't think I would have been around if it wasn't for him. He has been my everything. And I will not, I don't say this lightly, but I'm not easy to live with, as you can imagine. But I'm not scaring him at all, right? He's just in it, full time, super committed. There's one thing, two things I'm very proud of in life. I mean, in this podcast, we talk about job and career and how incredible it is that I've had this journey and that I have this journey. But the credit goes to my private life, 100%. I have the most incredible children. It's not easy for them either to be my children, right? Imagine. And he is my guardian angel. It's incredible what you can do in life when you feel loved. That is incredible.
I think that's true because I think that frees up. Look, people are either anxious about money or relationships and also health.
Yes.
And if you're not, if you don't have the anxiety, so let's say that's equal thirds in people's, let's say,
I like that
pie chart of emotions. Mm-hmm. If you don't have the anxiety in the relationship, I think that's so much extra energy you could devote towards career and health. You can't start a company if you're arguing with your spouse every day.
You cannot. You cannot. Yeah, I think you're right. And we agree on everything when it comes to our core values, right? We agree on how much money do we feel comfortable making or not making, right? Where do we want to live? What does freedom look like? How do we want to raise a family? What makes us happy? And I'm kind of sad you cannot see it because I'm sitting in this great light and we have this studio. And for everyone that's not watching, I have an incredible studio. But what you cannot see is that I'm sitting at my kitchen table in my 2-bedroom apartment in Palo Alto in Silicon Valley. And I'm sitting here because we left for US 7 years ago, but only 2 years ago, we started a company. We started over. And I went from making hundreds of thousands of dollars a month flying private, having a private driver, to living in a 2-bedroom apartment, and I have started all over again. And I'm sitting, now I'm responsible for a small startup that is worth $30 million, and I created that from my kitchen table. Again.
And that's Happio, right?
That's Happio, yeah, that's
and
Happio.
And you do this AI software, so like let's say we were having a meeting, and you know, a lot of things are said in a meeting, often nothing gets accomplished and nothing gets done afterwards. And your software takes, from what I understand, it's like an AI that sort of analyzes the conversation in the meeting and figures out the tasks and the goals and the things that are supposed to happen after the meeting.
Almost. Close enough though. But a meeting is usually divided into 3 processes, before, during, and after, right? You were mostly explaining what happens during a meeting, but in fact, what we are mostly doing is that we are putting a spam filter on Outlook. So every time you invite someone or someone invites you, if I invite you to a meeting, James, then Happio tells me, oh, you cannot invite James unless you tell him you cannot invite him unless you tell him why he's invited. What is this? What is the objective of this meeting? Who else is coming? What is he supposed to present? And what is the desired outcome? So we put it on the top of your Outlook or Google or Apple Calendar or whatever. And it's an enterprise software. So it's really an AI spam filter for meetings.
Oh, that's great. That's very useful. And how's you obviously raise money at a $30 million valuation or
Yeah. I mean, Well, it's we have a $30 million valuation, and we have raised $7.5 million from some of the most remarkable investors in the Bay Area. And the reason I'm mostly proud of this is that, back to our main conversation, is I've never done this before. It is really the first time ever that I have been raising capital, that I have been the CEO of a startup myself. When I came to the Bay Area, I had no network. I have no relationships. I had never, ever spoken to a VC before.
How did you, when you just moved to the Bay Area, how did you start? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's definitely networking conferences, but I find those to be a little bit annoying, actually, in the Bay Area.
Yeah, it's hard. You have to be a little bit on the spectrum. I think I'm good at figuring out how to get along with people and find out, you know, again, how can we build something together? How to talk to this person? How to make him or her interested in investing in our joint future?
And I guess if I'm a VC and I see that your background, I would think, okay, obviously she's been in thousands of meetings, and so she knows the dynamic. Yeah. She knows the DNA of a meeting and what can go wrong. So, okay, I trust her on that. Mm-hmm. And then I would think, well, she has these relationships inside Microsoft, HP, exactly. Other large companies that she sold to. So my worst case scenario is probably she could sell the company to somebody she knows eventually at one of these places. This is what I would be thinking in the back of my head.
Yeah,
so that if I put like $2 million in and I have a liquidation preference, I'm at least going to get $2 million out,
yeah,
is what that, I would how I would think about it.
That's actually also what I think. And we have money from, Salesforce, Microsoft, all kind, you know, so yeah, you're right. We have the most incredible investors. So that's right. I think they think, what is the worst thing that can happen, right? And I'm not a quitter, clearly. So, we actually managed to raise a significant check just last week.
Yeah, seven and a half.
That's a good round. Everyone here, I don't know how it is in other places, but at least in the Bay Area, not a lot of people have done up rounds, right? We 3x'd our valuation, still in seed, actually, which is very unusual.
That's unbelievable. Like it 7.5 out of 30, and you're in seed or series A.
Pre-revenue.
Like right now, particularly 2023, yeah, pre-revenue, that would have been unheard of.
Unheard of. So, the thing is, again, I'm beating the odds, right?
And the AI, the fact that there's an AI component also helps, because everybody opened up new AI funds. Mm. They wanted to put the money to work to show that they were busy. So you had a good timing too.
I have a good timing. You also have to understand timing as well, of course. Yeah, and I think being a woman of color and immigrant and all these things does help, unless you look at them as, you know, something that's going to victimize you. But, you ask about US. I became an entrepreneur in 2007 already. This is my fifth startup. But this is the first time I take VC capital, which is kind of interesting. It's an interesting journey. It's not for everyone.
No, because it's a different type of company then. Like, you have to use all your marketing skills, not to sell your product, but to basically sell your ideas in exchange for investment.
Equity. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet you still have to prove traction, right? I mean, early stage software companies, what you ideally want them to have is a hard lineup of proof of concepts, early adapters, letter of intent, ideally contracts, a good CTO, great tech team, all these things. So you have to do a lot of things at the same time. I definitely aged the last 2 years. I definitely aged 10 years. That's how I feel.
It must feel like that, because I think to some extent, I mean, I've started a whole bunch of companies.
Yeah, you
and
have.
I think that's such an unpleasant feeling to go through, kind of like you've gone through this classic startup phase, particularly with this last one where, software, using all the buzzwords, you have all the relationships, but then you have to make the VC relationships and then make a pitch deck and go up and down Sand Hill Road or whatever road is there now. And I find that to be so unpleasant that I lean towards starting companies that are profitable from day one, I get a customer first and then make the product, or I invest in companies that, I find it better to be an investor than an entrepreneur these days.
Yeah, I feel you. Well, you know, I did not start building any, not even a string of code. What I did first was I went to the biggest aviation company in the world and I sat with the chairman and I explained, remember, again, finding the first client before anything else. And I said, if I built this, will you buy it? And he said, I will buy it. And we signed an agreement and we agreed on a price. And then I start building.
So I see. So what's critical there, because I've heard that story before, mm-hmm. and then you build it and then they don't buy it. But yeah. What's critical there is that you got the agreement.
Agreement, and you agree on a price. And, you know, just this morning before I went on this podcast with you, one of our investors just introduced us to the three largest companies in Europe, just in one call, right? She also happens to be the chairman of the biggest company in the world. So I think, you know, it's also about really your team is one thing, right? But also picking the right customers in the beginning. You know, you want to be associated with the right brands, the right people.
Yeah, if you're associated with like blue chip brands that are using your software and have hundreds of offices around the world, people, it's one of those things which you're probably familiar with the saying mm-hmm. that since you were at IBM, mm-hmm. oh, you can't get fired for buying from IBM was like
you're
their slogan.
So right. You're so right. So, beta is not for everyone. It's hard to be a beta software company. But I will say, I'm very proud of what we have accomplished this far. But I will say, and you know, now we spend a decent amount of time talking about what I have been through in my life. I will say that being a founder the past 2 years in Silicon Valley has been the mental hardest game I've ever been through in my entire life. And I know it must sound silly, but I've never been this afraid for my own mental well-being. I've never been this worried. I actually have never had a situation where I said to my husband, if this continues this way, I think you have to lock me up somewhere for a week. I've never been there. I've never been this far out.
What's been the hardest part?
I think it's the psychological pressure. It's all the rejections. I mean, I'm used to being rejected. You know, James, even when I was a child, like when I was first grade, I invited kids over for my birthday and my mom had prepared a birthday meal, but no children came. Right? I mean, all my life has been like that. Yeah, it's horrible. Sometimes my children even cry when they hear stories about my childhood.
Oh my gosh. Because
it's so sweet. But listen, that's okay. You know, I've been rejected everywhere. I couldn't get a job. You know, I had to leave my country and everything. But it's the pressure. I was warned against becoming a founder in Silicon Valley. I don't know if it's Silicon Valley-ish or if it's just, I don't know, I was warned that this would be hard. It's a combination of a lot of things. Everyone you meet are anxious somehow. They look super calm, but very well put together, but the psychological pressure here is enormous. I mean, on my right-hand side, I have Tim Cook, he's my neighbor, Apple. I have Larry Page, Google, on my left-hand side. I have Steve Jobs' widow, Lorraine, lives down the street here. And I have Marissa Mayer on my left. Right. So my street is just crazy. So even if I raise $7.5 million, my neighbor just raised $2.3 billion or whatever, you know? I will say, in a way, you do sell your soul a little bit. Yeah, I think that's...
I think, do you think in every sales situation you sell your soul a little bit?
I don't know. I think the VC game is just slightly different. I don't know.
Yeah, because I guess the dream for them is they want to make 100 times their money. That's like real
times.
Success.
Yeah, they don't want 10x or 50x. They want 100x. They want to go for
right, because they figure on average their fund is great if after 10 years it's 10x up overall. So that means they need to aim for the moonshots. They need to aim for the 100x. You know, things.
Yeah,
And it's hard.
But
it's hard to pitch them.
But James, it's still a privilege, right? I cannot sit here and whine over the fact that I'm running a tech startup in Silicon Valley, right? It's a privilege.
I don't agree. I think you can. I think
can. Can I?
Yes. Because now I've mentioned in the beginning and then just now we mentioned the rejection aspect, mm-hmm. and you said it, you repeated it as if you were reminding yourself, oh no, I went through all the rejection when I was younger. But mm-hmm. you know, it's never pleasant to be rejected even once. And even now, even after all the armor you've built up, Mm-hmm. It's never pleasant. And it is constant, the rejection there. And plus, not only that, like you said, everybody around you is a billionaire or a 100 millionaire or whatever.
Yeah, they are.
And so there's a lot of pressure in that sense too. Like that's going to, not like an envy sort of pressure,
no,
but it's just around. It's just in your head. It's taking up real estate. Like Silicon Valley, I think is weird mental real estate somehow, which is why I never moved there. But I always wondered if I should. Like I never did, but I always wondered if I was going to regret it later, moving there.
You just moved-ish, right? So will you put another move and you're just settling where you're living now? But you could live here. And I'll tell you why. Because you love learning. You love people. You love stories. And you know, I've never lived in a place where there are so many smart people. Everyone you talk to, it could even be a mom. Nothing against mom. I'm a mom myself. But listen, a mom who's picking up her second grader, right? And you just talk to her for 5 minutes, then she has a triple PhD from Stanford and she's rocking science. You know, everyone here is smart, right? And so I don't know about you, but I feel like a third grader every day.
I bet you that's exciting. And I know a lot of VCs in Silicon Valley. I know a lot of people there. Mm-hmm. And I probably know some of your investors, I'm sure.
Yeah, probably.
And everybody is super smart. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just never plunge to go out there because I knew it would be all consuming and I don't
all consuming I, it is all
I
consuming.
Don't know if I could handle that. Like I like to do many things and I'm sure you do as well, but when you're building a company like that that's in the middle of Silicon Valley and it's going to be VC funded, it's got to be your 1000% focus.
Well, everything else suffers, right? To be quite honest, yeah you have to focus. And I don't know.
Do you feel like you've over some hurdle now that you've raised this round and then you've got these customers? And
yeah, it's really weird. You know, we raised $5 million just a few weeks ago. We signed the term sheet and everything. And I signed it, another big fund came, like the dream fund of my life, and said, well, we would also like to put in between $1 and $3 million. And I'm like, really? So you kind of get this snowball effect, right? I don't know. Until the money is wired, until the new team member starts, then it will always feel a little surreal. So I don't celebrate just yet, even though that everything is signed and stuff. And I know it's pretty.
Yeah, there's always the next thing. Like now you have to, like you've been doing, you've been closing customers. Okay, but now you've got to deliver the product and collect the money. And,
exactly.
And then you have to show growth, because if without growth, the valuation sort of falters. And it is never ending until you sell the company. And then the most dangerous part begins, I think. After you sell the company, that people kind of hold off being sick until their companies are sold.
Oh, really?
And then you have to watch out. Well, I don't want to scare you, but I've known people who it's as if you could kind of like force yourself to be healthy until all that stress is over. And then your body's like, okay, can I be sick now? And then it all comes out. So that's always a point I warn people, like you've got to be careful at that moment.
Well, yeah, it's definitely something to think about. I will say I live more healthy now than I've ever done before because I cannot afford to waste any brain calories, right?
Sure.
Sleep, exercise, alcohol, anything. You have to be super aware and awake. It's almost like taking part of Olympics, but for entrepreneurs, right? You don't go to Silicon Valley and build a startup if you want to just be-ish successful. You go here if you want to and you believe you can make it big. Otherwise, you don't go here, right? Then you go to, I don't know, Berlin or London, or no offense, but but you don't go to Silicon Valley if you just want to half-ass it. You have to go here if you really believe you can make it big and your software can be part of, you know, the standard suite of Microsoft or be bought by Zoom or whatever, right? You don't go here if you,
Now, do you get worried? AI is moving so fast. Do you ever get worried that, okay, someone could just tomorrow?
Of course.
I don't think your moat is probably not your product. It's probably your relationships, really.
Yeah, it is. It is. And the contracts, right? And today I spoke to one of the biggest companies in the world, right? And they're pretty sophisticated on AI already. And they said, we have not seen a product that is doing what you do pre-meeting. It's really the pre-meeting market space, right? No one is attacking that. Everyone is doing note-taking and post-meeting follow-ups and stuff, but no one does anything pre-meetings, which is really weird. because you can diagnose a low quality meeting long before it takes place. Who cares about what is going on during the meeting, right? Because then you're there, right? But I really don't want you to be in that meeting at all if it's not worth your time.
Yeah, so, I can see how like, so if let's say I'm the CEO of a company and I'm evaluating your product, I could think to myself, well, can my IT department do this? Well, do I really, the budget set, do I really want to dedicate their resources to this when I could just buy this product right here? It's just off the shelf.
Yeah, I mean, you should ask your CTO, right? If you are a CEO of a big company, hey, listen, John, Ben, Jane, how many percentage of our meetings are worth people's time? If the CTO cannot answer this, then you need our product.
Yeah, and so that's good. Well, congratulations on the round. That's incredible. And really, congratulations on everything. By the way, I should mention, you write a column for Forbes, and your column today was Snoop Dogg talking about self-mastery. So I just wanted to ask, like, how do you, and I believe you. I actually once wrote an article that's, this was about, I think in 2014, I said Snoop Dogg should be CEO of Twitter because he was jokingly himself saying he should be CEO of Twitter. And I said, here's 10 reasons why Snoop Dogg should be CEO of Twitter. And he reposted it, like he retweeted it and said, he's got the message. So I think I agree with you.
Snoop Dogg is fantastic. I think he should deserve much more applause than he does, right? He's so extraordinary, talented and insightful. Yes, I write for Forbes. I have a weekly show for the World Economic Forum. Every Saturday, I interview head of states from this humble kitchen table, right? It's pretty awesome. I've done that for 4 years. I've interviewed Malala. I've shared a stage with Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, I've done incredible stuff in my life. And that despite the fact that I learned to speak English in 2007, right? I mean, everything I've done in my life, I've done it through hustle and access to free education online. I really just wrapped it together somehow in my own way. I should tell you, by the way, when I built Happio, one of our investors gave me a playbook, how to build a successful SaaS company. There's a playbook for that. I looked at it. It was next to me lying next to me for a few months. And I was so obsessed about it, right? And only when I threw it out, that was really when I started thriving. So I also think sometimes we are so obsessed about reading how things should be done that we forget to maybe follow the flow, surrender, see every situation, even every person we meet, not categorize them as good or bad, but just as a learning. And well, I really believe that life will not let me down. She has invested too much in me to let me down.
And I think also you have so much experience on every side of the table, that is going to propel your business forward more than a book, more than some kid who, you know, built a SaaS company and sold it for $400 million and then wrote a book about it. Mm. Like, you've got the real deal on both sides. You're providing value. And I think always leading with value is really strong.
Yeah, and then being sincere in why you're doing it, right? You spoke a few weeks ago, have you done that a few times in your podcast? Building something meaningful is what needs to be done. You cannot, I mean, hope is important. Passion is important. All these things. Motivation. I don't believe in motivation, right? I'm driven by my principles and healthy routines. And then I have vision and it has to have a great deal of purpose.
That's a real interesting thing you just said, that you don't believe in motivation. Because
I don't
agree with that, because if you only work when you're motivated, you're going to work one-tenth of the time. Like, you have to, what success is working when you don't feel motivated. You know, when you wake up and at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. or whatever you do, and you get up even though you don't want to.
Yeah.
And that's success.
I mean, it's just like anything else. I don't know about sport. You know, I didn't grow up with sport. I couldn't afford the privilege of thinking about sport. I was trying to survive. But when I was 15, 16, I started exercising and, you know, I started running. And fast forward, I've done a few extreme races since then. You know, I did a few Miss Fitness competitions. It's bodybuilding for women. I've done all kind of ski marathons and whatnot, just extreme stuff, right? And every time the recipe has been the same. I sleep in my gym wear, right? I put my shoes out so when the alarm went off at 5 a.m. I don't have to argue with myself. Do I feel like running? Of course I don't feel like running. So I don't trust my motivation. Motivation comes and goes, but your principles and your routines, they are there to stay. So you better make sure that you have healthy routines. Of course, you're not a machine, right? I'm not a machine. But just 2, 3, 4, 5 healthy habits overall in your life will set you up for success. And you know, I am really not that smart. I am not.
I don't believe that. I don't believe.
No, James, I'm serious here. I'm not, you know, I have not had math since fourth grade.
That's not smart. I mean, that's not an example of...
Okay, but you know what I mean. I'm not educated, right? I keep laughing because people are so much more educated than me. And I actually think it's a good thing that I'm not super educated because I can afford, I have the privilege of allowing myself to be an amateur. And unlike a lot of people, I don't care if I only have one subscriber for my newsletter or one whatever, because I have always started out with nothing. Nothing has been given to me at scale. And you can laugh. That's fine. People have laughed at me many times. You can reject me. You can let me be all by myself alone and don't invite me to anything. That's okay too, because I've celebrated birthdays and Christmases all by myself. So that's not a punishment. So in a way, even if I lose everything once again, I do know who I am when I have nothing, and I can live with that too.
Well, it's been such a pleasure having you on the podcast. I'm glad our mutual friend Avatik introduced us. And where can people find you? Like, or where do you want people to look for you?
Well, I love connecting on Twitter. So Twitter is definitely a good place, but I also have a homepage, sulaima.com. It's just my name, sulaima.com. And then, yeah, LinkedIn also, Instagram, I'm also active. I'm just really honored to be on this podcast today. I had no idea.
The honor is all mine, believe me.
Really?
Yeah, I was very excited. Like I said to Avo, our mutual friend, Oh, you have to introduce me. Like he started to tell me a little bit your story. And I'm like, no, just I'll ask her about it on really? The podcast. I'm really grateful you're here.
Yeah, I don't know. Here's the thing. You are the most humanized author and podcaster in the entire world. So the honor is all mine.
Oh, well, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. Thank you so much. And again, come back on anytime. And, you know, it's been such a pleasure having you on. So I'm really grateful.
Thank you so much, James. Thank you so much.
Ask Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off Duration and SuperDeck products May 17th through the 20th. That means 30% off our most popular color family, blue. Psychologists have found it to be soothing and relaxing, which makes it especially great for bedrooms and bathrooms. And of course, get 30% off all of our other colors. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.